Welcome to the Totem Figures Podcast. I'm TJ Daw. Greta Vosper is the pastor of West Hill United Church in Scarborough, Ontario. She's the founder and chair for the Canadian Center for Progressive Christianity, and she's the author of the book With or Without God, Why the Way We Live is More Important Than What We Believe. Her totems include Meg Wheatley, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Claudette Colvin, and Marie Bouclain. If you're not familiar with any of these names, don't worry, neither was I. We started out talking about Meg Wheatley.
First person I want to mention, she's not on my Mount Rushmore, but she's the first person I want to mention is Meg Wheatley, who's an educator in the United States. And she wrote a book called Turning to One Another, which I read probably 6 years ago, maybe a little longer ago than that. And Meg Wheatley's premise around changing the world is very, very simple, and it's start a conversation. And from that conversation, things will happen. It doesn't matter if you have an idea that can change the world, that can end world hunger, that can make the life of your elderly neighbor better, if you don't actually share that idea with someone and have a conversation about it, because you can't do everything yourself, right? So she calls people into groups, she works with them and helps them build their confidence in terms of offering those conversations and getting people involved in conversations, starting conversations in places like churches like this, or community halls, or apartment buildings, or the park, and just stimulating people's ideas around what the possibilities are and where it might end up and what the world would be like if. We're always toying with new programs to have here at West Hill, and one of the programs that I've toyed with over time is a program called What If. And just what if? And if people came and brought ideas about what if we did it this way, or what if the community focused on this, or what if children were put in classrooms according to Enneagram type, you know, what would it look like? And would that be a positive move? Would that be a negative move? How could we use it to make the world better? So I think Meg Wheatley and her conversations is sort of the beginning of some of my ideas around this Mount Rushmore thing.
How did you discover her work?
Found a book, just saw a book one day in a bookstore, picked it up and was engaged immediately by what she was saying and how simple it was. And so probably in 2004, I preached an entire sermon series on that book, on the conversations and the things that we need to do in order to be open, vulnerable, honest, with each other, and caring enough to hear what other people bring to the table, even when it's not something that you want to absorb into your lifestyle or that speaks to who you are or the realities in your life, we have to learn how to have a conversation about it. And so in particularly difficult and troubled situations, if you know how to have a conversation, that can make all the difference in the world. So the work that she does around North America, I think, is crucial in making change in a large scale, beginning from very simple places to start with. So before I go any further, I need to tell you that you've made me cry so many times in the last couple of weeks as I've tried to think about the people that I would put on this, because I come across voices that have sought to change the world with such a passion and such a clarity, such truth, that it's one of those beautiful things that cannot be tarnished. And over and again, the world has rejected those voices, has silenced them, has ignored them, has rebuffed them, has done horrible things to them.
Labeled them as heretics. Executed them, dismissed them.
Destroyed the things in life that they love. I think of John Trudell and the American Indian Movement in the States, and he was part of the group that took Alcatraz and constantly was talking about the rights of his brothers and sisters, and was threatened constantly with violence, and finally his whole family was killed in a house fire, which they believe was probably set by the authorities. And people like that who have literally poured their lives into the work of changing the world, where they were at, whether it was a small piece of the world or a big piece of the world, they poured their lives out into it. And that's, I mean, people ask me regularly why I'm still a Christian, because I don't believe in the divinity of Jesus, and I, you know, all of those things.
Well,
don't believe
God.
That there's a supernatural theistic God. But it's because that story, those things that Jesus is purported to have said and done, and quite honestly, he probably didn't say or do most of them. But what I take away from that story is the image of someone who said, never stop, never stop trying to make it better, no matter what it costs. Use your whole life and pour it into what it is that you think needs to be better in this world. So I ground the work that I do in that image, whether it's fictitious or whether it's real. That's the image that feeds my passion, right? Is that I have so many moments, and I want to use those moments so that when I leave this world, when I'm gone, when I'm, you know, annihilated into, you know, dust again, the world will be a better place because of the energy and the life that I poured into it, right? So that's why I still call myself Christian. But
and do you think that lies at the core of Christianity, or at least in the best of circumstances?
In the best of circumstances, I think it can, but too often the church has done exactly the opposite to that. It has not seen itself as pouring goodness into the world. Many, many, many people in Christianity have spent their lives putting goodness into this world, using the framework and realities of the context in which they were doing it. And sometimes we later learned that that was not the best thing that could have been done. But at the time, given the information that they had, they were doing the best that they could. But far too many as well institutionally have wreaked havoc in the world, destroyed cultures, annihilated whole ways of being, shut down national memory or cultural memory in order to preserve, you know, some created form of Christianity that they wanted to preserve. And I mean, the reality is that any Christianity is only somebody's perspective of Christianity. There's no such thing as Christianity that we can all weigh and measure and, you know, stick our fingers out and touch. It's different for everybody, and it's all interpretation. And until we recognize and really honor the truth that it's a human construction, stop giving it this divine authority, we will always be at risk of being led, being controlled, being advised by those who take it as a divine imperative, and quite wrongly so. So I think Christianity has a lot to offer, and I think it has cost us a lot. So,
but there are other figures in history, like Gandhi, for instance, who stood up for what they believed was right.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
What is it specifically about Christianity or the example of Jesus that draws you to that?
I wasn't drawn to it. I grew up in it. That's my starting point. That's the only reason. If I had grown up in a secular household, then I might go to any other voice. I mean, one of the pieces of work that we're about here is taking Jesus away from his centrality as that figure. So I rarely talk about Jesus here. We don't read from the Bible very often. I mention him maybe 3 or 4 times a year, and usually at seasons like Christmas and Easter, and no one gets out the door thinking that I think anything in those stories is factually true. But I mention him here not because he's central in a significant way, because I think that he is an example of maybe one of how many billions of lives that have been poured out in that manner, right? So he's maybe the first person that sort of made me aware of that, or helped me recognize what someone else was doing with their life next to that story, juxtaposed with the biblical record and my interpretation of it as growing up in a liberal church. So he's not central anymore. He's one of like these millions and billions, most of them nameless people, who have done that same thing, whether it's been a mother or a father pouring their lives into their children so that their children can grow up and be lives that bring beauty and goodness into the world, right? They may not have had the opportunities that their kids are going to have, but their kids go out there and do that. I mean, I want to honor them just as much as I honor someone who's already in bronze someplace. Anyway, so
let's talk about your
Mount Rushmore. Okay, my people.
And in particular, one you'd like
to start with Matilda.
Okay.
Matilda Joslyn Gage. She was a suffragist in the women's movement in the States. helped coin and write a lot of the literature for that movement as it was getting going. Grew up in a household with a father who constantly exposed her to critical thinking, didn't allow her to adhere to any particular set of beliefs because they came from an authoritative place. She was always to examine and think for herself.
What era was this?
Mid-19th century.
Quite remarkable.
Yeah, it was very early. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was one of her close friends. But I chose her because her perspectives were far too radical for the women's suffragist movement. And so she was really, in the last many years of her life, she didn't connect with most of the women's suffragists because they were afraid of the radical nature of her perspective. One of the things that she did was write a book called Women, Church, and the State and exposed the abuses that women experienced in the church, spoke about the women's movement being taken over by conservatives, was very vocal about rights extrapolated as far as she could see them into the future. It wasn't that, okay, we'll just work on this little next step and that will be fine. Her vision was way ahead of that. I don't know who it was that says, never get so far ahead of the troops, you're seen as the enemy. Was that Napoleon? I don't know. But anyway, she was seen as the enemy by the troops eventually, and so cut off from that movement. So I picked her because she's not known, because people don't remember who she is. She was one of those early people who was rejected and scorned and silenced. They tried to silence her. It wasn't very effective. But the work that she began has now come to fruition, right? And without her voice, without the initial conversations, without the understanding that she brought and the challenge to think further, we wouldn't have got where we got.
What do you think kept her going?
I think that her early formation, I'm really quite amazed at some of the stuff that her family allowed her to grow in. There's a great piece in Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible where they say something about women's education. Don't know whether women's education is like pouring water into boots. Don't know if it's wasting the water or ruining the boots, right? And that's at her time, you know, in the mid-19th century, early to mid-19th century, women were not really given an opportunity to explore in the way they did. My grandmother graduated from Queen's University in 1908, right, which was a huge accomplishment, but this was 75 years before that, right? And her father was teaching her critical thinking, and I think that formation allowed her to remain convicted about her views and wanting to constantly set them forward in a way that would unfold in whatever way it had to. I don't think she shied away from the controversy. She wasn't trying to be political, by which I mean like to get, you know, the best situation now by giving away some stuff there. I think that she had learned early on that you speak your truth and you hold to it, right? And so I think she's great.
Okay. Who's next?
Okay, next one's Claudette Colville. A young black woman. Claudette is one of four women who were part of the Montgomery bus boycott, but not, because Claudette was, before Rosa Parks ever refused to get out of her seat, Claudette refused to get out of hers and was torn from the bus and arrested. And initially, it was believed that here was a champion that we could recognize and we can make a change here. But she was found to be pregnant. She swore a lot, didn't have the demeanor that would add grace to that kind of an undertaking, that sort of political action.
Was she unmarried?
She was unmarried. She was 15, I think. So the case, her case against the Montgomery bus lines, along with the other three women, eventually won. She was never heralded as a hero for her actions. Rosa Parks was much more suitable. She was more gracious. She was a better fit for, you know, the poster child. And so I added her because there are a lot of people like that who make choices that will instigate change, but who are not honored for making those choices and who end their lives, you know, in poverty, in ignominy, in utter rejection. But the conversation that she started by refusing to give up her seat, by being dragged from the bus, was a conversation that had to be had. And so it did happen. She started it, but she's not remembered by anyone for doing it.
So she created a legacy without any of the glory.
Yeah.
Just doing the right thing because it's the right thing.
Just doing the right thing. That's right. That's right.
What happened to her after that?
She lived a life of poverty, and nothing happened to her. I mean, she just lived a life of a young, unmarried black woman who ended up facing all the challenges and frustrations and losses that that lifestyle provided and is so known for.
And yet still helped some very important
Made
political
very
changes
big
happen.
Big difference in people's lives. So she goes there. And both of those women and the next one, people would look up at that thing and go, who are they? Right? The next one is Marie Bouclin. Marie lives in Sudbury. She's a woman who lay on the floor here at West Hill United Church a couple of years ago on a bright red cloth as she was ordained as a Roman Catholic priest. And so made the choice to move out of her community of faith in which she was very active, made the choice to not have a relationship with that community anymore, but to seek ordination as a way of fulfilling one what she felt was her calling to minister to people within the Catholic Church in a way that is creative, life-giving, affirming, all of those things, and risking being excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church for doing so.
And has she been?
No, she wasn't excommunicated. As far as I know, the last time I spoke to her, she hadn't been. Many of the other women who were ordained have been excommunicated by their bishops. Marie, when she was here, we talked about what this meant for her life, because she had a significant ministry. Women have very significant ministries in Roman Catholic churches, and she had a very significant one. Her ministry has been with women who have been abused at the hands of Catholic clerics. And she was very established in the church in her community. But she would never, because of her ordination, she would never present herself for the Eucharist to a priest again in her life, because she knows that that would risk his ability to continue to minister in the Roman Catholic Church too. People will never remember Marie's name. She will fade from history, probably as quickly as Matilda and Claudette have faded. But she's one of those voices that is demanding change in the Roman Catholic Church. She's not the first. She's one of the first to be ordained on land. Mostly women were ordained in waterways so that there was no diocesan control over them. So this was the first place where they had the courage to do it on land in a particular diocese. So I'm proud to know her and to have been part of that. Actually, the red cloth is rolled out on the floor across the front of the sanctuary, and it's to be a symbol of the Holy Spirit and the people who are being ordained lie face down upon it, down there for like 10 minutes while the liturgy is read, while they're lying there. But I laid it with Irshad Manji, and Irshad is the woman who wrote The Trouble with Islam Today, Muslim, lesbian, feminist. And we unrolled it and laid it down there. And I saw in that, and Joanna Manning was here too. Joanna is a feminist Catholic. I saw in that a symbol of the courage of women making changes in their communities of faith and in the world. And that these people who were being ordained, all women except for one married man, they rest upon and walk upon the monumental change that has been brought about in the world because of the vision that women who are often outside the circle can see the circle operating as. So they see it, so they can change it. So I thought that was very powerful.
Women's accomplishments are often swept under the rug in terms of the grand telling of history anyway.
Yeah, yes, you're quite right. That's quite remarkable the way that happens. So
it takes an even greater, I guess, sense of idealism to do the right thing, even though you're pretty certain that you're not going to be famous in terms of history for anything that you do, no matter how great
your
sacrifices
are. And none of these women,
are.
I think, would have expected any grand ticker tape parade for what they were doing.
Which really argues to the fact that they were doing it for the right reasons.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's one of the questions about religion and the value of religion with a supernatural theistic God. If we're doing things because that supernatural theistic God is going to kick butt when we die, then are we really doing it for the right reason?
Or reward us.
Are we really doing it for the right reason? So that's three. The fourth one is faceless. The fourth one is faceless because those three, and I realize they're all women, and there are many men out there like John Trudell, who I mentioned before. My Mount Rushmore would have the three faces carved and then the other one so that others could aspire to creating some kind of change through a conversation they had, through a perspective that they brought, through some kind of love that they lived out in somebody else's life, that they started that ripple themselves. And we all have the capacity to do that. We all don't always have the opportunity to do that, but my dream is for a world that one day we will, and that we will all reach that place of personal fulfillment because we have achieved some form of communal fulfillment. So that's the faceless final one.
One final question. Mm-hmm. What is it that keeps you going? Is it the positive responses you do get from people, or is it something else? Like, if you weren't getting these responses, would you still be doing what you're doing?
Absolutely, because it needs to be done, and because it's what I do well, and it's because in my continuing to do it, I'm honoring this community who has come together to do this. Like, these people are amazing, and I do it for them as much as for anything else. But
what if they weren't here?
If they weren't here, if I wasn't in the church, no, I might not do it. I don't know. I would lament and cry and be extremely sad, because if I stopped, it would mean it's not going to happen. There's nobody yet who has picked it up at this point. But that's the whole, that's my whole Easter story, right? Like, that's how I tell the Easter story. It's about having that dream. It's about being one of these people, Claudette Colville or Marie Buclin or Matilda Gage, who had this idea. They died or were denied the right of being recognized for what they've done. Their dream got totally trampled, but it happened anyway because somebody else picked it up and made it happen. That's how I tell the Easter story. It's not that somebody was bodily resurrected. It's that this vision that I think may have been in that story, there was something happened that brought communities together to tell that story over and over again, and embolden themselves to walk into places of disease and to give up all their earthly belongings and to take all the food they had and put it on a table with, a whole pile of other people and have to divvy it up and get whatever they got out of it. There were people who walked into those situations for some kind of a reason. And I think the reason is that they'd become dreamers of that same dream and they could not let it die and would not let it die. So even as I say, would I give this up and walk away from it? My hope would be that if I had to let this dream go, that someone else would start dreaming it and make it real.
But even if they didn't, would it still be worth doing?
So there's no positive feedback from anybody whose lives being changed. There's no community. There's no... I think so. Religion creates too much evil in the world. It's too, in this day and age, with the kind of weaponry we have, with the kind of, return to conservatism in a negative word way. I mean that term, not conservative values, many of which are very, very good, but in this lurch to the right, religion becomes a very powerful tool. And you can manipulate whole generations, whole governments, whole countries if you weave them the right tale. And we have so many of those tales that can be told in so many different ways. And so find ways to commodify the rest of the life on this planet. And I don't think that's ours to do. So, yeah, I'd probably keep it up.
For more information on Greta Vosper, go to gretavosper.ca or progressivechristianity.ca. I'm TJ Daw, and this has been a Totem Figures podcast.